What's up, guys? Welcome back to the show, and you've tuned into the very first episode of How Do We Know It, right? On this channel, we ask, what is truth, and how do we know it, right? How do we know it? And today, what I want to do is I want to give you an introductory kind of overview of all the things we're going to be going through. And I'm going to start it off by saying this. We live in a story, right? We live in a story, and that story has an origin story. I don't care what you believe. I don't care what your worldview is, right? You have to understand something about how things began. Where did we come from? And you may be a secularist. You may believe that, you know, everything came from nothing and cosmic soup was struck by lightning and things just evolved and we're just one big happy accident. You may have a story that God created us. You may have a story like the Enuma Elish that many gods created man for work. There's all kinds of different origin stories that you could have. And that origin story matters. And it matters because it will give you a sense of meaning to life, right? Your meaning to why you are here will flow out of that origin story. Your morality, right? That which governs you, the accountability that you have in this life will flow out of that. And then ultimately, your final destiny, the resting place of humanity. Will there be justice or will there be none, right? All of that will flow out of your origin story and what you believe about that. Now, there's a couple of different ways we can test these stories, right? The ways in which we can test truth claims. There's a correspondence test, that which corresponds to reality, right? History, claims. How do we evaluate those claims? I believe that is the best way to go about it. There's also a pragmatic test, which says that's which is useful and beneficial, which I think is absurdity. I think that's a ridiculous way to test truth, but I can understand in a secular worldview, a materialistic worldview where nothing's truly meaningful, there is no morality and there is no destiny. I can understand how the pragmatic view evolved, and that's what it evolved out of. There's a consensus test. That which is true, people generally agree with. Again, I'm not there. I understand what they're saying. I can see some truth in that, but it's also very dangerous to formulate an entire position around that. And then a coherence test, which is truth coherent with other people's belief systems, right? Again, I can see that. Things need to be coherent, but simply saying that you need to tie all these things together. Now, what I can see is that you do see a lot of systems out there and there is some similarities in them and you would expect that to be true, right? Typically the worst lie is something that's very close to the truth, right? So because I do believe that all worldviews are out to try to understand the world and the activity of the world and things that have happened throughout human history, and it's our man-centered ability to understand those things and write those things down. Because I do believe that, that's where I would say some of this consensus and coherent truth test makes sense, right? It makes sense. But it's really about, in anything, the differences, not the similarities, right? It's about the differences, not the similarities. And so I would argue that all religion in the world outside of Judeo-Christianity, and that's what I'm going to be arguing for, is man trying to understand the activities and events in the world through his finite, broken means, right? Man is constrained. We're constrained by time, space, and matter, right? How could we ever arrive at a right conclusion, right? And even if we did, how would we know it, right? How could we even know it? Because we cannot know the eternal. The reason I became a Christian is because that is not the claim of Christianity, that man has to, in some ways, on his own, being in his constraints, find out the truthfulness about the eternal reality. It is a claim that God entered into the world, right, and made himself known to us. He revealed himself to us. That is the claim. And what's beautiful about it is it can be empirically tested, right? It can be empirically tested. And I believe God wanted it that way. And I think that's why Romans 1 tells us this, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all ungodliness, godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth in their wickedness. Realize how it doesn't say truth, their knowledge, right? We're not suppressing truth in our knowledge, and I'm going to get to that, okay? It's in our wickedness. And because it's in our wickedness and not knowledge, since what they may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. So God has said, I've made it plain to you that I am God. I'm going to show you that. For since the creation of the world, my invisible qualities, eternal powers, divine nature have been clearly seen and being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. So God says, you have no excuse. You'll have no excuse on that day when you meet me to say, I just didn't know. You didn't know, not because of knowledge. God has given us plenty of knowledge to know, but because of your unrighteousness, your wickedness, your desire to be your own God. We're going to see that in the story, right? And so, yes, these claims can be tested, right? They can be tested. And claims are sources of information, right? Sources of information that can be tested and verified and shown to be true or false. This is a source. This is our primary source in Christianity, right? Most primary sources are some sort of a text, which is why we'll talk about textual criticism, right? And the claims of the Bible, when tested, what do we see, right? What do we see? Well, number one, we see we have a God who communicates, right? We have a God who communicates in different ways throughout history, right? In different ways throughout history for His own reasons, some we understand, some we don't understand. Sometimes He does it in person with Adam and Eve, right? He walked in the cool of the garden with Cain. He visited Cain and told him that if he did what was right, right, he would be accepted and that he needed to be careful. He gave Cain a warning, right? Sin is crouching at your door. You must master it. He also came in what we call types and shadows in Genesis 18 to visit Abraham, right? The Jesus, right? We would understand that to be Jesus, right? Coming in kind of a typarchy, right? And we'll talk more about that as we get in. God also communicates through His Word, right? His Word. And you can test this Word, and we're going to talk about how we test it and how we can know that it is what was written down, it was communicated from God, and it was transcribed well as it was passed down from generation to generation. Ultimately, though, He came in His Son, right? He, the Eternal One, broke into a world that was lost, that needed to know the truth, and God made certain that you would. That you would know the truth. This was His greatest revelation. And then He also made Himself known through His Holy Spirit in the way in which He works through the church, right? They cut the head off the snake, the Roman Empire, the Jews. They were trying to destroy the movement of Christianity, right? The way. It was called the way. Little Christians, the way. They were trying to destroy it. And what did they do that? What any man would do. They killed the Messiah, the leader. They cut the head off the snake. And what happens when you do that? It's over. The movement ends. That's how it always was. That's why we see, I think, in Acts 8, Gamaliel, a Jew, stands up in a crowd and says, after they move, I think it was Peter and John, they told him to go out. I may be getting that wrong. But he says, hey, listen, guys, look, we've killed Jesus. If he wasn't the Son of God, the movement ends. If he was, you better stop. Leave him alone. Because you're not only fighting them, you're fighting God. And that's what we saw in the early church, right? The explosion of it. And not only the explosion of it, but the testimony of Jesus that it would explode. He said, I have to go. I have to depart from you. The disciples were like, how is that a good thing that you would leave us? And He's like, hey, listen, I got to go. I'm going to send back the Helper. The Helper's going to dwell in you, and He's going to expand my church. And that's exactly what we see. So Jesus made a claim, and then what we thought should have ended it all, actually, we test His claim, and it explodes the church. Why? Because it was true. Because it was true. And now Jesus lives in all of us through His Spirit, right? Through His Spirit. So the Bible, it's a source document, the Old Testament. We're going to look at these things. How it was given and transcribed and how it was passed down is unbelievable. The type of discipline these people had. Also, the prophecy of it. Like 30-something percent of the Bible, the Old Testament, is predictive in nature. So they're predicting things and it's happening. Some 351 prophecies that just Jesus fulfilled. Just Jesus fulfilled those things. The New Testament, we're going to look at textual criticism. It's called a bibliography test. We're going to look at the internal and the external. You're going to see how we can know that the document that we have today was what was written down and we can trust that it was passed down correctly. You're going to see that. You're going to see some clarity through contrast of other documents in history, and you're going to be like, whoa, most definitely the hand of God was on that. If this is what other ancient text and antiquity looked like, look at this. And what you're going to see is there was a divine power that kept this. There was a divinity over the writing of this and also the protection of this throughout human history. Why? Because we have a God who desires for us to know Him. and he has made it easy to do so if you so want to. You're also going to see the uniqueness of this book, right? The authorship, 66 books, 1,500 years, 40 different authors from all walks of life and all time periods, backgrounds, occupations. You had kings, prophets, fishermen, shepherds, servants, priests, physicians. You had three different languages, four different continents. You had all of this, yet you had one common theme, God's salvation of mankind, that points to the central character of Jesus Christ. And this is fundamentally ridiculous if it's not true. No other book is done this way. Muhammad goes into a cave. He comes out with the Quran and says, follow me. Convenient. Mormonism, Jehovah's Witness. An angel comes to him, helps him transcribe Egyptology. Here it is. Believe it. Walk in it. It is the truth. Convenience. There is nothing convenient by the compilation of the Bible. 1,500 years, you just heard it, 66 books, there's nothing convenient about it. And only a divine hand could have delivered this to man. Only a divine hand. You see this also in the external sources with people that would have been close to the eyewitness testimony of other people in Tacitus, Josephus, right? These men, 56 AD to about 120. The other one was about in the late 30s to early 100s. I don't remember right off the top of my head, but you have other sources pointing to this Jesus, and that these people, they believed him to be the Son of God. I mean, they're not saying they believe that, but these other people did, right? And they're pointing to the fact that they killed the Messiah, they went and they hid, they were scared to death, and yet 3 days later, something happened that caused them to go out and die the worst deaths in all of history. What could explain such a transition, such a change, such a small period of time, 3 days. What was that? Outside of a resurrection, nothing. Nothing could explain it. And they did it just to make it harder on themselves. It wasn't even a spiritual resurrection. It's like, nah, he came back physically. Yeah, we seen him and 400 others. All kinds, just go ask them. You could ask all kinds of people. They saw him. Yeah. They just made it harder and harder on themselves. No one would do this. No one would make up a story this way. It's absurdity of the highest level. And then we read in the book some science, how we see that this book was so far ahead of its time in the way in which we thought human knowledge would be. We see the anthropology and the cosmogony and how it has a human story that just relates to us and helps us understand ourselves. And it has a cosmogony that makes sense of origin, meaning, morality. It makes sense of it all, right? And it makes sense that it seems as a divine nature, a divine power, a God is communicating to us what all this means, right? Who we are, who the world is, and what he's up to in it. And then we can empirically test the geography and the history of it, right? The ground is verifying this book, this story, this narrative. And so what do we see in all of this? Like, what are we really seeing? What we're seeing is that we have a God who is a relational God, who made man in his image for a purpose, and he's made himself known to man. And ultimately, back to Romans 1, that man does not know God, not because of knowledge, but because of wickedness, because of the suppression of the knowledge of God and his wickedness, and because he wants to be his own God. And in the end, you will have no excuse. You will have no excuse because God has made it known to you. I need to give you that warning. You will have no excuse. And we're going to go through all the apologetics. We're going to go through all of this and more. And I'm going to show you how clear it is to know that there is one true God in the heavens, and that he has communicated through his word, and that you can know him, and that you are rejecting him in your unrighteousness if you choose to do so. See you in the next video.